Hello and welcome to Card Knock Life, episode 127. I'm your host, Corey. Daryl is still off moving to North Carolina right now, kind of moving into a hurricane. So we've called in some backup here, and Zach Goldman is back with us. Hey, Zach.
Hey, also in a hurricane.
Also in a hurricane, also in North Carolina. In fact, you got a nice, like, hurricane-like ambiance going on your microphone, this kind of, like, eerie in the background.
So it sets the tone. That was actually probably Harley growling at the people walking by outside.
Well, man, I want to talk to. We'll keep it short today, but I want to talk about. There are a couple of spoilers that are really tickling my fancy, if you will. As well as we had, you know, we'll kind of cover these GP Detroit results. That was Team Unified Modern, and then also I have a little bit of a discussion about IDs into top eight. So, got to start by saying we are sponsored by ManaTraders.com. If you're interested in checking it out, use the promo code CARDKNOCKLIFE, all one word, for 14% off your first 4 months. But without further ado, let's jump right into these GP Detroit results.
Oh, yeah.
first place team, three guys I'd never heard of, but congratulations to Andrew Lopez, Antonio Perez, and William Corson, playing Jeskai Control, Mono Green Tron, and Five Color Humans. You know, we haven't seen a lot of Jeskai Control lately.
Yeah, so the thing is like, the format has gone really heavily toward these, like, mid-range decks, combo decks, and, decks like Tron and kind of things of that nature, and there's been a lot of creatures flying around, and Jeskai is pretty good versus some of those creature strategies, but has a tough time with some of the ones that have a little bit stickier creatures, like Bloodghast or Gravecrawler. Also has a really hard time at times with combo decks, just because so much of your deck is removal, whereas the blue-white deck focuses a little bit more on having kind of mass removal and high-quality permanents. And the best part about playing a blue-white control deck is your sideboard. So you get to play all these super powerful white hate cards in blue-white that you may not play in Jeskai because you need a more diverse removal suite to kind of deal with the aggro thing. So blue-white has kind of been dominating, and if you're anticipating a lot of blue-white control, the best way to win that mirror is to play red.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly puts up a good fight. It you know, you match the Teferi with your own Teferi, and I think in that matchup, even better than Jace is that Teferi plus one, draw a card on tap.
Yeah.
And so to have access to, like, all these burn spells as your quote-unquote removal pieces, like, they can also go to the dome when you don't have creatures to kill with them. So that's really nice.
Yeah, it can be nice in just that, like, Jeskai can usually turn the corner, so to speak, pretty quickly by just, like, you know, like, Bolt Helix, Snap Bolt. This particular list is really, really strange. And a part of me wants to say the card choices are a little weird because it was Team Unified, but, like, neither of the other decks were fetchland decks, and that's something else to definitely address with Team Unified as a format, I think. Maybe even before we get into deck and card choices, is because it's Unified, for anyone that doesn't know, that means that you can't have players on the team basically playing multiple cards across different decks. So if you and I are on a team and I'm playing Scalding Tarn, you can't have Scalding Tarn in your deck.
Yeah.
So typically, what that's going to mean is you're going to have one, you know, traditional modern mana-based deck, like a Fetch Shock kind of mana-based deck, like your Jeskai, your Mardu, your even like your company decks. You're going to have one Ancient Stirrings deck, probably Tron, KCI, or Hardened Scales Affinity. And then you're going to have one kind of oddball. And the deck of choice, obviously, for the winning team was Humans. You get to play this kind of suite of rainbow lands and a lot of cards that don't really encroach on the deck lists of other players. But anyway, I just want to get that out of the way.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. Playing Jeskai, though, you leave open, like, a lot of the, like, Jund color lands, which is kind of like the opposite side of that spectrum. Because Jeskai mainly needs the Tarns and the Flooded Strands.
Yep. Yeah, and there's some teams that did well. Like, there's a team that did well that had Mardu and Blue-White on the same team, although I don't really want to go into detail about how awful I think this Mardu list is. It seemed to have worked out, but again, the thing that you always have to keep in mind with team tournaments is the metas are super weird.
Yeah.
They're super inbred, and you can get really strange skewed results based on that. You might have somebody on a winning team that got carried all weekend long. They went 0-15, but right. both of their 15-0. So it's really kind of hard to tell what happened. But I think Jeskai was a good call for this tournament just because there was a lot of humans, and traditionally Jeskai's a good humans matchup. And there's a lot of people playing blue-white control. I'm not really sure how well Jeskai does against a deck like, you know, Spirits obviously is a tricky matchup, the blue-white variation in particular.
Yeah.
But, like, some of these other decks just look like really hard matchups for Jeskai. Like, Hollow One's kind of difficult, although, again, this Jeskai list is super weird. I mean, he's playing Peak, he's playing mainboard Settle the Wreckage, he's got a Torrential Gearhulk in his sideboard. Like, this dude's all over.
Yeah, yeah, the Torrential Gearhulk I've seen more and more with these Jeskai lists. In fact, one of the sideboards, and I can't find it now, but it seemed to be running a Torrential Gearhulk and an Academy Ruins in the sideboard. So you can, like,
I saw that.
Put the Gearhulks back on top, you can put the Explosives back on top. It's pretty nuts, but it makes sense. I mean, Gearhulk is like this big threat, but it's also really susceptible to removal. So if it's going to get killed by like a Terminator, a couple of bolts or something, like, to recycle it is pretty gas.
It's really interesting. I think it was like a blue-white control list. I think that...
Blue-white control?
I think it was blue-white control... Oh, actually, hold on. Is this it? Yeah, it was on the third place team.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, and I actually... This is interesting because he's a little bit more of the Miracles deck, and I've got a proxy gauntlet of 12 different modern decks sitting about 3 feet away from me, and that's usually what my playgroup do all our playtesting with, and we've been trying out a couple different control builds, and I think the smoothest one is the Blue-A control deck. It's a little closer to the more traditional. That's not really all in on this Miracle package.
Yeah.
So it's not playing Opt. It's not playing any of this garbage like Telling Time or any of that. It is playing two Terminus rather than two. So it's like two Terminus,
rather
two Verdict.
Four.
Yeah. And you know, all your traditional stuff like your Serum Visions. And I think that's going to be the way to go moving forward, rather than being all in on this Miracle strategy, because when you go all in on this Miracle strategy, I think you lose a lot of percentage points against matchups that aren't really just trying to play these big, dirtily creatures, or that are trying to take this, like, you know, on the ground approach to turning things sideways to attack your life total.
Yeah.
I think you need to take a more traditional control approach moving forward in this meta. And, like, one of the big developments that I've seen that's not really a new thing, it's something that was existed in the past and is kind of coming back around. Is the addition of Crucible of Worlds to these decks, which I think is huge.
Anyway, so let's move on. I want to just look at the number two, the second place team here. Paulo, it says Victor Damodarosa on MT2 Goldfish, but I assume that's Paulo Vitor Damodarosa. Unless he just happens to have 3 out of 4 names the same. he's playing Spirits. And these Spirits decks are like sort of becoming stock with 4 Collected Company and 3 Aether Vial. They just want all of the cheater cards in the deck at the same time. This can't be right, can it?
So here's the thing, is like when you build your deck, you have to make some concessions to your deck building, and there's so many things as a Collected Company player that I'm looking at this deck list and I just want to beat my head against a wall. So in general, when you're building creature decks and you're looking at having like a really tight curve of creatures, you need to either play Collected Company or Aether Vial. And the problem is, if you end up playing both of these things and a full set of Path to Exile, you're dramatically lowering your number of Collected Company hits in game one. And then he's got a ton of sideboard cards that aren't Collected Company hits. Now, green-white takes kind of a similar approach in that. But it's strange to me. And also, in my opinion, Collected Company is not very good in these Spirits decks anyway, since it's mostly 2-drops and some 1s. And the Collected Companies out of the Spirits deck have always just looked super unimpressive to me. And then
they can be really good. The ceiling is very high. If you can get 2-drop spell captain or a draw spell and a Phantasmal Image, you're living the dream.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think it's doing a little bit too much trying to play Aether Vial and Collected Company, because what ends up happening is you just end up with a lot of really clunky draws. I did some playtesting once with a green-white Taxes deck this was like a year and a half ago, that was playing Aethervile and Collected Company, Ampath, and Thalia, and I pretty much put it down and told my friend it was a pile of awful, please don't ever play this again. It was just so awkward, but like, the thing I'm looking at is like, the sideboard has four Collected Company hits.
Yeah.
One of them shuts off Collected Company, so you can't even cast it. One of them, you need to be playing on turn two, realistically, maybe turn three if you're playing it, and it's just a one of that is extremely important. Geist of St. Traff, it's a card that if you want it, you want it on turn two or three, and there's no way to reliably find it. There's no Eldritch Evolution, there's no Court of Calling, there's nothing like that. Trying to hit it as one of your random six cards is like, I hate that logic. I hate when people put these like one of company hits on their sideboard and they're like, oh, I'll just find it off Collected Company.
Yeah.
I wish I could be that good at RNG to be able to do something like that.
It's not truly a toolbox deck, right? It's just a value yeah. patch with Collected Company.
You're not even that. Well, okay. I'm sorry. I see there's two Geists in the main board. I completely messed that. So that's my bad. So that's just a third copy of Geist of St. Traff. And the thing about Geist and the Spirits deck is like, it doesn't improve your bad matchups, and it's only good in matchups where you're already favored. So it doesn't really make sense to me in that deck as a whole. Like, yeah, sure, it's a spirit. You can go turn one Noble, turn two Geist, turn three attack for seven. That's pretty sweet. But, mm-hmm. like, you know, there's people out here, you know, making a billion mana and pirate spell bombing you to death on turn three.
Yeah, I think with the matchups where Geist is good, it's just really good, and it's where, like, the number of Geist in these Spirits decks has just steadily increased over the, you know, 3-4 months that this deck's been around. Understanding at the beginning was that it wasn't good enough to play in the deck at all, and people were opting for, you know, like, Phantasmal Image in its place, or, like, a Birds of Paradise in its place, and it was like, okay, well, this card just, like, hoses the decks that it can crush, and it's good for that purpose. Now, you're right. There's really no functionality with the spirits in it other than getting +1/+1 from a Drogskull Captain or from a Supreme Phantom and just being a little bit bigger. But you're just not playing Rattle Chains. This deck's not playing Rattle Chains.
Yeah, Rattle Chains is, like, the best card in these decks.
that's what I thought, too.
It allows you to play all at instant speed, which is where this deck really gets a lot of its juice from, and I've played against this deck many times, and I can tell you with great certainty, it looked much better when they had a Rattle Chains in play versus when they didn't.
But now they've got Vile, though, to serve that same function, though. You know, I mean, it puts the creatures into play at instant speed, and it kind of takes the place they were running, like, a fifth mana dork. Like, they have four nobles and one birds, so they can get their three drops on time. This kind of, like, stands in, right?
Aethervile doesn't attack for two or more.
Right.
It also doesn't blank removal spells, and it'll only let you do one thing per turn. Whereas if you have, you know, some mana and a Rattle Chains, you can just kind of dump your hand, kind of mana permitting. And obviously, PVDDR is a very good player, much better than I am. I just don't personally agree with those deck building decisions, and it's been a lot of the talk in a lot of the forums and groups and stuff like that. I personally just think the guy's an absolute madman, and I would probably be willing to bet money that he would not show up to a regular GP with that configuration.
You think so?
Yeah, I think this was a team GP special.
Okay, well, they got second with it, and I don't know who was really responsible for that. The other two decks in his team were Sam Party on Black Red Hollow One and Matt Nass on Hardened Skills. Now, notably, Matt Nass is not playing KCI.
Yeah, I heard a rumor that Matt Nass actually pioneered this Hardened Skills deck. I don't know if that's true or not. I probably should have done my research on that, but it doesn't surprise me that Matt Nass showed up with an Ancient Stirrings deck and did very well with it. So.
Similar in the expected. What's that?
Pretty much to be expected, I think, point for Matt Nass. Exactly. He's going to register, you know, some number of Darksteel Citadel, probably, and some number of Ancient Stirrings, and some number of Mox Opal, going to be four.
Yeah, so this deck is kind of interesting. Like, the animation module is really good in it. It's very fun to see that do its job. But he's got one main deck Evolutionary Leap, which I'm particularly interested in. That's really good with your Hangerback Walkers and your Arcbound Ravagers and whatnot.
Yep. So we we have this deck is one of the decks that we have proxied up in our gauntlet, and we have an affinity player in our group who has been trying to transition to Hardened Scales, and he just doesn't really like it. It's a little too far off of traditional affinity for him. But the Evolutionary Leap is really sweet. It's really great at converting your junk into not junk. And also, it's just really good at enabling Modular. Sometimes you're just like sitting there with like an Arcbound Worker and a Walking Ballista, and you really want to move these counters over, and you don't have an Arcbound Ravager. So Evolutionary Leap is essentially, in my opinion, it's almost like a fifth Arcbound Ravager that finds more creatures. Which in some situations can be even better depending on kind of how the game shakes out. But it's I think it's really, really good. And also, like I said, it can kind of blank removal spells. When somebody, you know, points a lightning bolt at your thing and you're able to just essentially draw a card, I think that's really, really powerful. And then the is pretty clearly just acknowledging the number of grindy matchups that there's going to be. You're going to get into the late game a lot against these like control and mid-range decks. So pretty much what you're doing is you're turning all of your creatures in the late game into two-for-ones, which I think is
just
really
clear,
insane.
You're talking about Animation Module, right? You cut out for a second.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, agreed. It's I mean, the choose a counter on target permanent or player, give that player another counter of that kind is good in so many ways here. Like when you've got the Hardened Scales out and you can turn that into two counters, or if you've got two Hardened Scales out and you turn that into more counters, that's very good, obviously. But the fact that you can have an Ink Moth Nexus dealing poison damage and you can start proliferating that poison damage, that's pretty special.
Yeah, I don't know if so. Like, I don't know if you played the Ink Moth Nexus standard.
No, I didn't.
But like, there were people trying like all stuff. Have you ever died to somebody just proliferating your poison counter? It feels real bad.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
So I think that's really sweet. Like between Throne of Geth and Animation Module, like you can in like the really long grindy games, because these permanents are generally pretty hard to remove against the decks that are playing a lot of removal spells. Like you have Colligan's Command and Cryptic Command. That's pretty much your ways of kind of dealing with them, you know, pre-sideboard. So if you chip in just one time with an Ink Moth Nexus, you can just kind of sit there and chip them away without even having to use the combat step, which is, I think, actually a very powerful thing to be able to do against a lot of these, like I said, just control and mid-range strategies, which you have to be able
to,
absolutely. You have to come prepared for that. I mean, if you're gonna bring a creature deck, and I think this stands for pretty much everything, if you're gonna play a creature deck in Modern, be prepared. You have to have a plan to beat the mid-range and control decks.
Yeah.
You have to. They're, you know, they're probably more dominant now than they've been in a really, really long time. And you can't just show up to a tournament and say, oh, I'll probably just dodge Jeskai and Mardu and Junk. Like, not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, they're good right now, and they're just inevitably the most popular like type of deck to play in the format. Everyone wants to play control. Whenever it's good, everyone's going to sleeve it up and give it a shot. Or at least it's heavily represented around here.
Dude, in the South, everybody thinks they're a blue mage god.
Yeah.
So I get to just go take Mardu to tournament and just beat up on everybody. It's hilarious.
You know, I heard a theory on it why people are so interested in that type of deck, and it's because when you're winning the game as a control player, you spend more time winning the game than you do losing. Because when you lose in a control deck, it happens so quickly, right? So, like, even though your win percentage might not be that high, like, the amount of time spent winning the game is, like, just so much greater than the amount of time you spend losing the game. So your experience of the deck is much fonder.
I think it can still suffer from the same issue as decks like Green-White and mid-range decks, where sometimes you have these games where you feel like you're winning and you're doing so much and you're just going, and then you lose. And then you feel like you have done so much work for nothing. And you're just miserable.
You sound like a recovering Valuetown player.
it's a disease. No, I was just talking to somebody it really is. It's a labor of love. I was talking to somebody about a half hour ago. Because I'm trying to find somebody to be a mod on the Green-White page, just because I've had so much stuff going on lately. I can't really, and now that I'm also a mod on the Mardu page, it's like even more going on, and so I'm trying to get some extra help with that. And someone's like, "Oh, why'd you turn your back on Green White?" I'm like, "Oh, hold on, I haven't turned my back on it. It's just really, really poorly positioned right now."
Yeah,
and
it'll have its time again.
It will. Selesnya will rise again.
Yeah, they're going to continue printing cards that are good for that deck. I don't doubt that.
But not the way these.
Not in the spoilers yet. Well, one. I think we ought to move on from the GP results, but let's just put it at this: Matt Nass is a god of playing Nature's Claim decks. I think that's his style.
That's how you fix Modern. You just ban Matt Nass.
You ban Matt Nass. Anyways, let's talk about. Before we jump to the spoilers, let me just throw up. I'm not going to throw up. Let me just throw out a little experience I had this weekend at the PPTQ. So I drove up about an hour north of here to play in Sheboygan. Maybe you've heard of Sheboygan.
I did. what show is it?
Oh, I don't know, man.
Wilfred.
Wilfred. That's right.
Yeah, the guy works for Sheboygan Lager.
There you go. Yeah, Wisconsin gets a lot of shit, and Sheboygan's one of those very Wisconsin names, so that one takes it a lot. But anyway, Sheboygan's a very nice place, and I played in a little game store that had a PTQ that maxed out at about 36, capped out at 36. There were 29 people that played in the event, so it ended up being 5 rounds. And I played the first 4 rounds. I go 2-2. I didn't do that great. I was playing green-white company combo, basically. My specialty. And yeah. My two losses were against the same damn deck. And it's a deck that I never, ever see in Modern. It was Green Black Rock. And that's a pretty terrible matchup for that deck because they've got all the discard for you. I've got no removal in my main board for all the Tireless Trackers that just take over. And it's just got like tons of removal in Liliana's. And
they get to play Fatal Push,
yeah.
Abrupt Decay, Assassin's Trophy.
Yeah, spoiler, we'll get to that soon. But yeah, you're right about that. I mean, that deck is pretty brutal for anyone trying to combo with creatures, and I just happened to face it twice in 4 damn rounds and lost to it both times. Both games were close, but one time I was reminded why I shouldn't be playing Ronus in my deck, and that was when he killed all of my other creatures, and I had him at like 1 life, and I couldn't attack with the damn Ronus. So, anyways, the point being, it came to the 5th round, the final round, and the standings were posted. And so, I'm not going to remember this accurately, but what happened was the top 6 players could basically ID into the top 8. And then the 7th and 8th player had to play because the 9th and 10th player had a pair-up situation. So, the 9th place player had the same record as 7 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked his opponent, "Will you concede to me since you have no chance of making the top 8?" And his opponent said yes, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what that means is it completely, like, it forces the players above him to play, even though, like, basically he was pared down because of his match win percentage or his record being worse than them. So he kind of got the upper hand from it, right?
So if he was pared down, that person's probably going to bubble out anyway.
Right, that's the point.
That's exactly what happened to me at the Open. It was round 15, and I got pared down, and I immediately was ready to just go home, because I knew that meant that I was going to bubble out on 9th or 10th place. I was furious. But my opponent conceded to me anyway, because he knew that there was no possibility of him making it into top 8 at a record best of would have been 11-4.
Yeah.
He knew there was no chance.
Well, that was what happened here, but it was also a situation where when this guy asked his opponent if he would concede to him, like, that guy was kind of like in a lose-lose situation because, yes, he's right, he's not going to make the top 8. However, he's going to piss off the other two guys that are affected by that decision, right? And there's really no reason that he has any, like, loyalty to this one guy that he's paired against. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of an odd situation that's presented.
So here's the thing. If they would have played anyway, and that guy gave him, gave his opponent hands and feet and won the match anyway, it's the same outcome. So,
well, is it though? If he lost the match, then the two guys above him had the same record could have drew.
He won. Like I'm saying, if the guy that asked for a concession played and won, it would have been the same outcome.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So here's kind of my thoughts is you can't affect other people's actions, and you know, you can't affect their actions. You can't do what they say, what they think. I think it's kind of a losing battle to try to convince people otherwise. And I've been in all of those situations before. The PPTQ a few weeks ago that I got second place at, I was in pretty much the exact situation of that middle table there, the 7-8 spot.
Yeah.
Now the luxury of being in that spot is if you win that match, you jump everybody.
Right. Yeah. So there's the advantage, right? You get to go first to the top 8.
Yes. So that's what happened, was I ended up having to play because I had the worst breakers, and everybody else, there were like a bunch of tables that ID'd. I was 4-1 and I was like, you know, let's battle. And I destroyed him and I ended up going in the top 8, I think in second or third seed. So I think intentional draws really make a lot of things difficult, but I don't think there's a way to fix that problem. You can't just say you can't ID.
Right, right.
You know, if there weren't any draws, I think it would be a lot different and we would have a lot more interesting cuts going into top 8. But there's just so many IDs. And, you know, at a small tournament, it does kind of suck because you'll have some players, let's say it's a 6-round tournament or even a 7-round tournament, right? So like the classic that I top 8 in is a perfect example, the Pauper Classic. That was a 7-round tournament. I only played 5 rounds. I went 5-0-2 in a top 8.
Yeah.
Cause I was first place after 5 rounds. So I was able to just draw. Whereas everybody else had to play 7 rounds. So when I started my top 8 match, I'm refreshed. I've been sitting around, you know, twiddling my thumbs for 2 hours and everyone else is like exhausted. I think you actually get kind of like in some senses a competitive edge when you're able to do that. But again, I don't really know how you can combat that. You know, what can you really do?
Right. That's the thing. That's the problem. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is this brought up kind of a really like anticlimactic finish to a Swiss, you know, to the Swiss portion of this tournament. And it happens every time you have something like this. But so for an event to only be 5 rounds to begin with, it's a pretty short event, right? To go 3-1, you can play the first 4 rounds and then the tournament is over. So I guess what I'm trying to say is rather than completely invalidating that 5th and final round or 7th and final round in your case, or even 6th, there, you know, I wanted to kind of bring up the discussion is there anything that can be done about this? Can Wizards have a policy on IDing? Can you force opponents to play? And my thought is there are a lot of reasons that this doesn't work, but I wanted to open up the discussion for that. It seems like to involve more people and give more people hope of making the top 8 is better for the game because there are more players that are feeling that chance, even if it's a slight percentage of, you know, my match win percentage is going to factor in here.
Right.
But to keep more people involved longer in the game is better for the game overall versus more people scrubbing out and going home after the second and third round because they got 2 losses.
So I have a really interesting perspective on this.
Mm-hmm.
It was to the point where we had local players literally making memes about it. I had, I think, 6 consecutive IQs where I got 9th place.
Yeah, man.
Earlier in the year.
Ouch.
And feelings is that when you get 9th, you come away with stone nothing at these smaller tournaments. And I went to one PPTQ where the store, you know, threw down some extra prize support. They were like, you know what, if you get 9th or 10th, we're going to give you, you know, however much in Chuck E. Cheese points as well. So I think a lot of, I guess, pressure to be in that top 8 kind of would fall off of people's shoulders if they knew that there was at least some kind of consolation prize. But to feel like you feel like you come away with nothing if you don't get into that top 8. And what really sucks is it's almost never a clean cut in these smaller tournaments. It's usually, you know, you'll have some X1-1s and then there might be one X2, but usually there's a bunch of X1-1s. So in my case, right, at Baltimore, now obviously that's a much bigger tournament, but there were 5 X3s, 2 of which were not in the top 8.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I'm still going to get a check in the mail from StarCityGames.com, and I am not too upset. But if you go further down in the bubble where people are battling to stay alive for cash, you get 65th place, you get nothing. You got the guy sitting in the seat next to you who has the same record as you, who did the same amount of work as you, and he's cashing and you're not.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the problem kind of comes up, is it's not even really the, you know, I'm in top eight and I get a chance to fight for this tournament. It's that I missed it because of statistical bullshit. And that's kind of the way that I've really started to look at tiebreakers. You just can't do anything about your tiebreakers. Like, it's gotten to the point where, like, you like, the only thing you can do is when you see your opponents that you've destroyed throughout the day kind of walking around the tournament, you just encourage them to keep playing and tiebreakers. It's like, that's pretty much all you can really do.
Yeah.
And I'm with you that it sucks, but I just don't know that there's any way that anything can be done about it. And I felt the burn, and I've been on every side of it. I've been on the side of going XO draw into top eight. I've been on the bubble. I've bubbled out of plenty of tournaments. I've been in that position where I've got a win and in, and I've won, ended up in the top eight. I've been in every spot. And it's kind of one of those things where you talk about it with most people, and it's the same thing every time. You hear the same set of words.
Right, right. Let me put it this way. And I don't want it to sound like I've never done this myself. I've drawn into the top eight before. In fact, it's just part of the game. It's not something that should be frowned upon at this point.
It's just part of Magic.
Exactly. But I guess what I'm suggesting is, I don't know if there's a way that we can, you know, kind of dampen the effect of just being out of the money on your breakers overall, or just reducing the ability of players to just completely, you know, bypass the last two rounds of the tournament. Like, how do we make people play Magic? That's what this game's all about, right? Now, imagine this though, Zach. If you were to force people to play the game and not ID, what would happen?
Say again, I'm sorry.
If you were to say that you were not allowed to ID into the top eight, if you're not allowed to ID, period, what would happen?
I don't really know. I mean, I honestly I don't think there would be anything wrong with that. I think that would actually be fine from a tournament playing perspective.
Yeah.
I've had situations before where people have asked me to ID and I've declined, and vice versa.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's fine. Especially like by that time in the tournament, you probably should know what your opponent's playing. So especially if you know it's like a good matchup, you kind of just put your balls on the table and say, no, we're gonna play.
Right. I mean, the thing is, there's no good way to do it, because we can control the talk about, like, will you concede to me? I'll give you a pack or whatever. You know, like the sort of like consolation for like giving you the win.
Obviously that is a faux pas. Yeah, you have to be really careful because that's considered collusion.
Right.
And that can actually mark your DCI record, and that can affect all kinds of stuff.
There is a precedent for trying to control the language that you use in those situations, I guess is what I'm saying. So if you have some rule against the conversation of intentional draw, it's something that it wouldn't be out of the ordinary. It wouldn't be unusual for WotC to pursue. But if that was enforced, you're forced to play the game. What's to stop you and your opponent from just taking an entire 50 minutes and ending in a draw anyway? You know what I mean? And that's just a net loss for everyone, because you have to sit there and watch them do it.
Yeah, and what it does is pretty much it would just create more work for the judges that are working these events, because they would now have to actually police these matches. And then, like, you can say, yeah, you can't ID, right? Like, there's currently, they say, hey, you can't concede to your opponent in exchange for some amount of prize support, or ask for them to do that or whatever. But people do it. That's just how Tournament Magic works. And if you say you can't ID, I mean, they can draw out the clock, they can play slow, they could just play their match and then fill out the slip anyway. As an ID, they could sit and play an entire round of Magic and then put 1-1-1 on the slip.
Yeah.
And who's going to police that? I mean, are you, is a judge going to say, well, this didn't happen, go back and replay your match? Or are they going to interrogate every player around them? Like, I just don't think there's really a good system for enforcing that kind of thing.
I don't think there is either. So I guess what I'd want to explore then, and I don't know enough about this to, you know, to really speak on it, but the issue that I have with it is when they post the standings and you have to sit there and do all the calculations of if this person IDs and this person IDs, it's like you're like basically tasked with not doing magic, but like doing math, you know?
Yeah.
And whoever's the best at doing math can maybe figure this out. And sometimes you're put into situations where you almost have to just like trust your opponent to like that they know what the hell they're doing, because they've figured out the tournament math and they know that, you know, if these guys ID, we're at an advantage to just do it too, right? And they might be wrong about that. You might get screwed. But what happens if they don't post your tiebreakers and they just purely post everyone's record at that point? You know, does that feel like we're being slighted because we are missing information?
Maybe, but the order in which the standings come out have to be arranged in some way, and I think that would be, it's dictated by tiebreaker, so even if you don't see your tiebreakers, you're still going to know.
That's a good point, yeah.
And also, based on, like, where you're seated is usually a good indication as well of kind of, you know, what things look like.
Sure. I guess that would have to be randomized or something in that case, but... Maybe
yeah.
there just is no solution, I guess, is the unfortunate truth here.
And their players are encouraged to play their matches. That's, you know, every single tournament you hear over the last couple of rounds, judges make an announcement, you know, decide your matches by playing Magic the Gathering.
Yeah. But then there's no enforcement of that. You know, there's no rule against it. So even though it's a recommendation from the judges, that doesn't mean shit, you know?
Yeah, and it really doesn't. And none of those policies do. And I had an instance where, and I'm not going to name any names because it's a higher profile player, where I was playing the final round of a tournament, and the player said, I would like to concede to you. Can we talk outside?
Oh, yeah.
And I was kind of puzzled, and I said, okay. And the discussion came up on, because there was some weird breaker math. It was basically, you know, after that it was, hey, all right, cool. You should be in. If you're in top eight, are you comfortable with giving me this percentage of your winnings for the tournament?
Wow, yeah.
And... that's something that you can't really control what people say to you and what come up. And it's just, it's very strange. And it's almost, I don't know, just all
uh-oh.
Weird. There's just not really anything you can do about it. Like, the match result was turned in. The match was over. Everything was done. We're not even, you know, in the building where the tournament is, or we've kind of walked away. And I just, I don't know, it was the first time I had seen anything like this, and
yeah.
I was confused and taken aback, and you see it happen all the time, and
yeah,
you can make policies and rules about it and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it happened to another friend of mine, too. He was playing a win and in for top eight with, again, another higher profile player,
yeah.
And this person offered my friend a percentage of their takeaway from winnings for the tournament in exchange for a particular match result.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to keep it as vague as possible, to not throw any names out there. So
yeah, they no doubt are trying to crack down on those situations. You know, so there's at least an attempt, and the threat is real of, you know, being disqualified. Or even worse, you know, and the thing is, like, in a situation where someone's being as cryptic as "let's talk outside," can you bring that up to a judge? You know, like, I think you do in that case.
So,
someone says, "I would like to concede to you. Can we talk outside?" I would say, "You already did. You just conceded to me. You know, we're gonna deal with this now."
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to, I guess, personal ethics and morals and integrity. Like, I'm the type of person where if somebody said that to me, I'm not gonna I'm not going to just like call a judge and be like, hey, my opponent's trying to collude or trying to bribe me, anything like that.
Right.
But that happens, and there are people like that. You know, it's like we have a guy at FNM who will have players split all the time because the way that the prize support's done at my local game store is based off of record, not place. So all the time, people will like get into the last round and they're like, you know, weekends, you know, ID and then play for the extra pack or whatever. And we had this one guy who just had an absolute fit. He's like, you're colluding. He's bribing you. And he's like, dude, it's FNM. We're talking about playing for one pack of Magic the Gathering cards.
Yeah.
Like,
what? Yeah.
Come on, dude. There's not even cash involved here.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think it's just so deeply ingrained in tournament culture that it's part of the game. And it stems down from a lot of people that do this professionally, and this is their livelihood. So they want to kind of fight tooth and nail for every dollar they can get. And I think that's where a lot of this stuff comes from.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, I think we ought to move on. We're going to talk about something a little bit more upbeat, and that is the Guilds of Ravnica spoilers.
A show.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but these are exciting me. Let me just say, as a side note here, Zach is cutting in and out a little bit. It is no doubt due to the storm and your connection. So yeah, I apologize for the issues there.
There's a little bit of, I can hear some thunder outside, so it's definitely going to start to affect the internet access. So I do apologize for that.
All right. Anyways, let's jump in. There are a couple of cards I want to talk about. I don't think we have to go too deep today because there are really about three of them that I think we have to hit right now. And then the rest can be sort of saved for the future.
I can probably guess. I can definitely guess two of them with great certainty. The last one's a mystery. I'm gonna guess it's Legion War Boss, Assassin's Trophy, and probably one other I don't know what it is. All right.
Well, let's talk about Legion War Boss real quick because we got Mardu guy on the podcast right now. Legion War Boss is 2 red for a 2/2 Goblin Soldier with Mentor. Mentor is when it attacks, you put +1/+1 counter on an attacking creature with lesser power. And at the beginning of combat on your turn, create a 1/1 red Goblin creature token. That token gains haste until end of turn and attacks this combat if able. So a lot of people compare this to Goblin Rabble Master. I mean, it's got obvious similarities to it in that it creates goblin tokens, but I think it is very, very different in function. Zach, does this activate your almonds?
I'm pretty calm at this. So your I do really like this card for standard.
Yeah,
my almonds are pretty calm. I would like this if I was to play maybe like a goblin strategy in an Eternal format with like Rabble Master and this card.
Yeah, that seems good.
But here's the thing, and I haven't done the math on how fast of a clock this War Boss is, but I can tell you I have done the math on Goblin Rabble Master. It does 25 damage in 4 turns undisrupted.
Yeah, this does not do 25 damage.
This is nowhere near that. So Goblin Rabble Master is a much faster clock. Now, I think Legion War Boss may have a home in standard and some kind of red aggressive shell. It's possible. It's really hard to say. We don't have the rest of the spoilers, so, you know, it's a little bit of a mystery. Also, like, there might be some kind of, like, big red deck with, like, this, the Siege Gang Commander, Skirk Prospector,
yeah,
mana, and you can make a lot of goblins, and I think it's really sweet. Like, this card, like, curving this into, like, something, and then, this into Trashmaster, and then into Siege Gang Commander seems nuts in standard. I don't know. I always enjoy some good old-fashioned red deck aggro. One of my very first decks that I built that was competitive was a red aggro deck. It was like a, it was like a Kuldotha aggro deck. That was a deck back in standard. You got to play Goblin War Driver, Signal Pest, Memnite with Kuldotha Rebirth, Contested Warzone.
Nice.
Really, really sweet. Goblin Bushwhacker was in standard with it.
Yeah.
Lightning Bolt. The card's cool. So I think this card's really great. The problem is, I think it's just really great for standard, and I don't know that it's going to really make a splash in modern. So the thing is like, it comes down, makes a 1/1, and that's it. And then the second turn you attack with it, so it comes down, first turn converts to 1 damage. The second turn it attacks, you get a second goblin, and you put a counter on one, so it converts into 5 damage. And then it goes up by 2 damage per turn. So it's 1, then 5, then 7, then 9, versus Rabble Master, which is 1, then 6, then 8, then 10. So it's a lot less aggressive, but I think it can still be a very fast clock. And I think something like this in Standard would be pretty sweet, but definitely I don't think really holds a candle to Rabble Master. The fact that this card remains to be a 2/2 every turn is what I find particularly underwhelming, whereas Rabble Master just gets massive very, very quickly.
Right. Yeah, this is not really a threat when it's attacking, and it also needs to attack to, like, you know, achieve its full potential. Unfortunately for Legion War Boss, it dies to just about every creature in Modern, including Snapcaster. So that's like setting up for the best Ambush Viper Lightning Bolt situation or Electrolyze that there ever was.
Yeah. Now, granted, while Rabble Master is the same convert mana cost, same body, same beginning of combat, you know, whatever, the difference is that if it goes undisrupted and it doesn't eat a Lightning Bolt or something like that, it's just going to end the game almost immediately. Whereas Legion War Boss is not that scary.
Yeah. It's no doubt a good card, and I think that there might be a place where you want all 4 copies of both. Obviously, that's some sort of crazy goblin token deck, but I don't know what that looks like. I don't know if that's going to exist ever, but I think this is strictly a Standard card, at least for the time being.
And what really sucks is Metallic Mimic is rotating out, so I can't even go turn 2 Metallic Mimic, turn 3 Legion War Boss.
Oh, yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, that is too bad. Now, I think if goblins can find another good 2-drop, I think it's a legit tribe for Standard. But right now, they're kind of lacking in that area. They've got the M19 guy.
You get Siege Gang Commander. You still have Goblin Chain Whirler, which I think, actually, I was talking to one of my friends about this earlier, who is known for a few open top 8s in Standard and is a very good player. I was talking to him about it. And he thinks that Goblin Chain Whirler is going to be pretty much very bad after rotation. Some of the biggest reasons that he's been so good is Soulscar Mage, the Monuments, Glintsleeve Siphoner, and Champion of Woods. And all those cards are going to be gone.
Yeah, that's true.
The card really loses a lot of stock, as well as a lot of like the token generators, all the like servo cards. Those are all gone.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty medium effect, a 3/3 first strike. But you still have Trashmaster, you have Skirt Prospector, you have Fanatical Firebrand, you have... did I say Trashmaster?
Yeah, you did.
Trashmaster. Yeah, Siege Gang. Like, there's a lot of goblins, but it's
2 drops,
like a...
2 drops. We need 2 drops, you know? That's the problem. The one I can think of is the one in red... Yeah, Wily Goblin's garbage.
I think it's red, it's one, but you get a Lotus Petal with it.
You do, yeah, but so who cares?
You can go that into turn 3, Trashmaster costs 4, right?
I believe so.
Alright, so here's the dream. You go turn 1 Skirt Prospector, turn 2 Legion War Boss, turn 3...
Siege Gang.
yeah, I guess. Yeah, like... Well, no, you have to sacrifice the Skirt Prospector to itself to do the turn 2 War Boss. So, like, that would be pretty sweet. Or you, like, turn 1 Skirt Prospector, turn 2 Wily Goblin. Or is it called Wily Goblin?
Yeah, Wily Goblin is the red, makes a treasure. Or makes a whatever they call the Lotus Petal.
It's a Lotus Petal. So you're like, turn 1 Skirt Prospector, turn 2 Wily Goblin, turn 3 Siege Gang. That sounds hot.
Yeah.
In your mono red deck, turn 3 Siege Gang Commander, dude, sign me up. But then you also get to play these like other cards that like if you don't have this like super aggressive like mana ramp, you know, kind of acceleration package, you have these like really fair but powerful 3 drops like Legion War Boss, Goblin Trashmaster is pretty nice. Although I will say, I think it's losing a lot of stock with the Mirrodin Redux rotating out. You don't really get the extra effect, so it's pretty much just a lord.
Right.
But, I mean, Goblin Lords are Goblin Lords. I don't know that... Oh, and Goblin Warchief's in this too.
Yeah, Goblin Warchief. But so they're really heavy on three drops, right? With Warboss, Warchief, the Chainflinger, whatever the hell.
Goblin. Goblin Instigator. Like, man.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot of really sweet goblins.
But the thing is, it can go one to three really well with the Skirk Prospector, so that might not be a big issue, you know.
Yeah, so, but goblins.
I guess we'll see.
And then the other thing, see, here's the thing, is like based on like how I start. Oh, Goblin Electromancer, gotta add blue, but that's fine. We got Steam Vents and Spire, or not? No, sorry, Spire Bluff's got it. We have Steam Vents and Sulphur Falls, so that's pretty good mana. That's a modern mana base right there. And then, I think we're probably going to get some more goblin cards. Boros historically has had, you know, goblins and humans are typically what you see.
Yeah,
so,
we'll see some more. I think we'll have some red-white goblins. It'll probably probably tease us with some hybrid brews, which is going to be tough for Chain Whirlers and whatnot.
If we don't, we will undoubtedly see some when we hit Rakdos in this block.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, no, you know, here, look at this. Legion Warboss in his text box has the Boros watermark. So I would guess that that's a pretty sure indicator that we will see more.
Of course. And there tend to be Rakdos goblins as well. So I'm sure we'll get some in the next set.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next card. So we talked enough about goblins and non-modern goblins at that. But I thought we had to have the discussion about Legion Warboss because it's come up quite a bit as an alternative to Rabble Master. I think that, hands down, is not going to replace Rabble Master and likely will see no play in Modern, but I would be happy to eat my words if a Goblin deck does appear. I guess there is 8 whack, right? There's one. So, anyways. Assassin's Trophy is next. You were damn right about that one. This card, I don't know how we couldn't talk about. But if you haven't seen it, which I'm sure you have just all over Facebook right now, it's black and green for an instant. Destroy target permanent and opponent controls. It does not say non-land permanent. Isn't that insane? It says, its controller may search their library for a basic land card, put it onto the battlefield, then shuffle their library. Zach, does this butter your biscuit?
I think this card's absolute trash. What I'll do is I'll get a P.O. box, and everyone can just send me their copies of this card for proper disposal.
It's got a $30 price tag already. It hasn't even been posted for
a lot of places. Yikes! All right, this card's going to level out for like $8.
It's rare, right?
Yeah, and this set is going to be open to absolute oblivion. I haven't bought a standard set since I think I think Aetherable was the last box I bought.
Oh yeah, and how long ago?
I'm probably going to buy a box or two of this because this set looks sweet already, and I personally want to draft it because I love Ravnica drafts. This card is the real deal. This is our modern breakout card for the set. Unless we see something else crazy, this is obviously our modern breakout set. And I'm surprised Wizards gave it to us so early. This card is the actual nut. And here's... Everybody keeps saying Jund, 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 Jund. I disagree with Jund being the deck that's going to benefit from this the most.
Well, it's certainly going to play it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like... The biggest thing this does is destroy Urza's Tower on turn two, which is a huge problem for Tron. It's essentially a Ghost Quarter on a spell, which I think is sweet, mm-hmm. and I think that's going to actually bring a lot to the deck. It also gives them a little bit more flexibility, so instead of having... So, like, here's the thing about playing mid-range and modern. You have to play a pretty diverse removal suite, and sometimes you just draw the wrong removal. So I think what this will allow the decks like Jund to do is have a little bit more consistency. They can, instead of having to play this, like, suite of, like, you know, split of, like, Dreadbore, Terminate, Abrupt Decay, Fatal Push, they can play some number, probably realistically, 2 to 3 Assassin's Trophy. I don't think we'll see 4, at least not in the main board. You might see, like, 3 main one side, at least at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
The other thing, too, is, like, this card is always a Bloodbraid Elf hit. Always. It
always
will have target.
Yeah.
This card is good against any deck playing permanents. Which is every single deck. Literally every single deck. So, I think this card's really sweet. But I don't think it's Jund that actually is going to benefit the most from it.
Yeah, what do you think?
So, I think the decks that are going to get the biggest boost are going to be the kind of black-green underdogs. And there's 3 of them. there's Black Green Rock, which we were talking about earlier, which, again, the reason it's not so good, you know, sure, Tireless Tracker's awesome. I love that card. She is great. But the removal hasn't been quite there because they don't get Terminate or I'm sorry, they don't get Terminate or Dreadbore or Lightning Bolt. So yeah. Assassin's Trophy really helps out in that kind of Dreadbore Terminate slot. Because it deals with the big creatures that they can sometimes have a hard time dealing with. It, you know, deals with lands. It does all these other kind of things. And granted, Black Green Rock does get to play, you know, Ghost Quarter, Field of Ruin, stuff like that. But this also can kind of take that spot. This also, I think, will make Abzan kind of closer to viable again. I personally, and we talked about this on the last podcast you had me on, I don't really like Jund, and I think it got worse when
Blood Raid Elf
unbanned.
Yeah.
And I think Abzan is actually a really, really good deck right now. I think it's actually a very good choice as far as Black Green X midrange decks, and Reed Duke agrees with that sentiment as he played Abzan at GP Detroit.
Yeah.
And I think this is a really, really good addition to that.
Yeah, Lingering Souls right now is no joke.
Can confirm. Card's great.
Yeah.
That's really great when your Lingering Souls also gets you a 1/1 red elemental token.
Yes.
Sign me up. Sign me up.
All right, so, you're going to go 4-color Mardu then. Splash Green for some Assassin's Trophy.
Nope. Don't like it. I don't like it that much. I think the card's really good, but I don't think it's enough to make Jund or Abzan or Green-Black better than Mardu. Now, here is the deck that I think is going to benefit the most from it.
Yeah.
Is the Sultai.
Yeah, man. I was thinking the same thing.
That people have been trying to jam. Ever. People have been trying it. And then when Jace got unbanned, they were like, oh, yes, finally I can play Sultai cards I own with Jace and Liliana. I'm just going to live the dream. And then all these like combo decks came out of nowhere, and they're like, yeah, that's not happening. And then the biggest problem there is, like, the blue and black removal is just weird. It's just not that good.
Yeah, you get forced into playing some funky things to deal with permanents. This is great for it. Snapcaster Mage and Assassin's Trophy is the dream right there.
Correct. And while Maelstrom Pulse is really good, it's a 3-mana sorcery, and granted you're mostly, like, a tap-out mid-range deck, because you're playing all these Planeswalkers, but you got to play, like, the Jace and Liliana, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think you could actually go away from, you know, the Goyfs and all that kind of stuff and play a controlling style of deck with a lower creature count, Snapcaster Mage, Search for Escanta. You can still play your Abrupt Decays and all that kind of stuff, because I know everybody loves their Abrupt Decays.
Yeah.
The problem is, Abrupt Decay does not kill, for example, Thoughtknotseer. Abrupt Decay does not kill Jace the Mind Sculptor. Abrupt Decay does not flip, does not kill Urza's Tower, does not kill Karn Liberated, does not kill Ugin the Spirit Dragon. It does not kill Celestial Colony.
Yeah, man, this just has, like, zero roadblocks in those situations. The only thing it doesn't deal with is Throne the Last Troll. But aside from that,
early on in the veil,
you've got a button.
Yeah, like, I think this card is hot. This is a card, if you have an opportunity to pick up cheap, pick up as many of them as you can. Because I think this is a card that's... Yeah, for sure. Like, this is a card that's always going to be worth money. I think it's going to level off kind of like Abrupt Decay did and land around the $5 to $8 range. Obviously, the hype now is huge. One of my things that I'm wondering is how good this card's going to be in Standard. After some conversation with my friend Max, I'm fairly certain that Abzan mid-range slash control is going to be the best deck in Standard coming up, with all the black, white, and green, just really powerful cards that we have. Also, the fact that we have Celestia and Golgari in this set means that we're getting some really good cards for both of those as well. But I mean, Assassin's Trophy. Sorry, I was talking to someone earlier about video games. Assassin's Trophy is the real deal. I think this is our new modern staple. And they just kind of put it to us, you know, gave it to us on a silver platter, and it's a story spotlight card.
Yeah, that's cool too. I think that's going to make the foils extra special. There's no doubt that this is going to see play in modern like crazy. And I don't think that anyone would disagree with that.
I'm going to tell you right now, this is going to get played in every single format where it's legal.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a card that I think we're going to see possibly in Vintage. It kills Mishra's Workshop, and among, you know, other things. It's definitely going to play in Legacy. 100% this will get played in Legacy.
Yeah. Oh, I don't doubt that.
It's instant speed Vindicate.
It's a sinkhole.
Two mana.
It's an instant speed sinkhole. Yeah. I mean, in Legacy, when you're playing the minimal basic land con in your deck, this is literally going to be sinkhole when you're playing the second and third one.
Yeah, Rug Delver plays zero basics. Yeah. Like,
Here's the thing. You didn't mention a couple of decks that I think this particularly shines in, and one of those is Abzan Company. Abzan Company plays, like, that's a deck that wants all 15 sideboard slots to commit to one, you know, singleton creatures for its toolbox answers.
And I forgot to mention it. I posted about it in the toolbox group earlier today.
Did you?
But a lot of people are playing Abrupt Decay and Abzan Company, and I think this is just an easy replacement for it.
That's my point. Yeah, they're playing three Abrupt Decay and they're playing three Path to Exile on sideboard in a lot of these cases. So more of the traditional Abzan Company decks. Mm-hmm. This one can replace, you know, four of Assassin Trophy or three of Assassin Trophy. Does both of those jobs in one card.
Absolutely.
So that's the advantage there. If you can board in to three cards that are non-creatures, I think you can keep some number of your collected companies around and still have some successful hits with them. But you can't pass up on the opportunity to destroy the problem permanents in those decks.
Any time you get an opportunity to lean out your deck list, I think you're in a really good spot. I think instead of playing these weird like 2-2 splits of Path and Abrupt Decay, I think you can probably just play four Assassin's Trophy. Now, granted, there are times where you want Path because it's just lighter on mana, but in general, I think this is going to be a better catch-all.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I think that's all great. The fact that we have this now catch-all answer to things in Modern that are just typical, like, big problem cards like Ensnaring Bridge and Blood Moon is going to make it, you know, more fair for the mid-range decks that are trying to, you know, play creatures and do things that you're supposed to do in Magic versus combo out and kill you. So yep. I'm all for that. I'm 100% on board this card. I think it's very cool. I'm concerned that it's going to change what Modern looks like pretty drastically when it comes out, similar to the way that Fatal Push did. And we might not see it at first, but the fact that we've got access to this really easily, easy to use removal, makes me think that a lot of decks are going to be incentivized to kind of splash green for this type of thing, or some of those mid-range like attrition decks are going to be kind of taken over again. I don't know.
So here's I had a conversation pretty much exactly like that with my boy Joe Stempo. Mm-hmm. Shout out to him. Also, his recent Standard GP top 8 out here crushing it.
Nice.
He and I were having a conversation because he was saying he read my article and it's making him want to play Mardu again because he switched to the weaponized variants deck, the Bridgevine deck.
Yeah.
And he was saying...
Weaponized variants.
Yeah, so here were his exact words. Trophy is very bad for Tron and not particularly something you want against green-black decks anyway. So he is looking, you know, and some of the context of the conversation is that he thinks that card basically is just being essentially sinkhole for Jund and Abzan, is going to pull players away from playing Tron and push them back toward playing their fair mid-range decks, which is definitely going to cause a meta shift.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see more control decks to kind of combat that, probably more combo and more just kind of fair decks. So I think this card is definitely going to kind of push the meta in one direction or another. I don't think it's going to affect things quite as much as Fatal Push did, but it's definitely going to have a non-zero impact on the format.
Uh-huh. Yeah, man. I think I'm excited to see what happens to it. Anytime we're pushed towards mid-range decks, that's a good thing. That's people playing the cards that they want to play. I'd say that it seems that most people are more interested in playing creatures and value cards than the lantern controls of the world. So, sure. Anyways,
I can't disagree there. I like value, and I like my big thing. And whenever people ask why I play these clunky, slow mid range decks, is just not lucky enough to play degenerate strategy, so I prefer to just play slow and fair, and you're going to go ahead and slow down and play fair as well.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, dude, there's one more I want to talk about, but before we get to it, I want to just kind of brush past Dream Eater, because I think this is a severely underrated card. Now, granted, it's only been spoiled today, so it hasn't had much time for people to kind of, like, simmer on it, but this is a 4 blue-blue Nightmare Sphinx, 4-3, Flying Flash. When it enters the battlefield, surveil 4, and when you do, you may return target non-land permanent and an opponent controls to its owner's hand. That's a lot of stuff that this card can do, and I don't know that we're going to see this in Modern, but at least for Standard, I think this is going to be all over the damn place in these blue control decks.
All right, 3 words.
Yeah.
Limited All-Star.
Limited All-Star for sure, my god. But the fact that this creature has Flash, I think, is kind of like the deal-breaker here. Not only is it, like, incredible card selection, it's also, like, kind of a catch-all removal spell, quote-unquote, because it bounces a non-land permanent on a stick that beats aggressively.
So here's going to be kind of all I say on this.
Dice Bolt.
6 mana, 3 toughness.
Yeah.
No hexproof, no can't be countered. Like, the first time you run into this thing into the syncopate for one, you're going to want to just beat your head against the table.
Yeah.
And
I can see it.
It's just not good. There's a couple other cards in this set that I'm much more interested in.
Well, this card functions similarly to Torrential Gearhulk, except it doesn't require that you have the Into the Royal in the yard or something.
Hold on just a second now. I think we're comparing two very, very different animals here.
Yeah, talk to me. What do you think about it?
I think that Gearhulk is an extremely powerful card advantage. It's a win condition. That card ran a train on Standard for a while, man. And the first Standard tournament in the Kaladesh season that I won, I went 6-0 in Swiss and then didn't drop a single game in Top 8. I was playing Jeskai Control right after Kaladesh came out, and I mean, that deck was just busted good. Like, 4 Torrential Gearhulk, sign me up. Although I think I was just playing 3 and 2 Archangel Abyssin, but that card also
fine.
Good.
I agree with you. Torrential Gearhulk is an insane card. This is a different card from it, but I think it fills a similar void, in that Torrential Gearhulk's going to rotate out, right? We're not going to go and slot in 3 Dream Eaters in place of the 3 Gearhulks that were in our deck. But what this provides is 2 things that you want from the Gearhulk, and that's removal, it's an answer, and it's card selection. And it does both of those things in its own way.
I understand that it does a lot of things. Like, the body on this thing is just outsized by so much that's already in Standard, and also what's coming in. I think the bounce a thing plan, like, honestly, I think this card should probably cost 4 or 5 mana. And at that point, I think it would be good. At 6, I just think it's too much. This feels like, with all that text, it feels like a 5.5 mana card.
I think we're underestimating what Surveil 4 can do. That's some pretty big advantage right there.
Maybe. Now, if we got to play with Surveil cards and Gearhulk in the same format, sign me up.
Oh, that'd be great, yeah.
But I'm not really, as of yet, not really seeing any particularly powerful Surveil payoffs, aside from these, like, really whack jumpstart cards, which are all pretty bad so far.
Really? Okay, so that's kind of where I'm thinking that this is going to be the most irrelevant.
Are you looking
so,
at
like
eight,
in the
one
in
and
the
half times?
What's that?
Are you looking at the card that I'm calling Think 1.5 times?
Yeah, Think 1.5 times. I can almost guarantee you is going to be played in Standard. That card is
yeah. Great. Yeah, no, it's Standard for sure. That card's sweet.
Yeah.
I'm going to put one in my Pauper Cube because it's sweet.
Yeah, that's like, so this is a 1 and a blue instant draw card, Jumpstart. Pretty simple, right? Think 1.5 times. Yeah.
And Jumpstart is a new keyword that says you may cast this from your graveyard by discarding a card in addition to paying its other cost, then exile it. So what it essentially is flashback. Where flashback is the converted mana cost of the card as is, but you also have to discard a card.
Yeah.
So, like, the problem is you don't actually go up on cards with Radical Idea, whereas with Think Twice you do. Maybe Think Twice is just, 2 powerful for Standard now, or you know, maybe they just don't want to bring back the you know, flashback tour.
Yeah, there's no flashback in this set.
I think Jumpstart Sweet, that's the only flashback card to me that looks, or see, there I go again. The only Jumpstart cards so far, and again, we only have one, two,
four of them so far.
Four. Yeah. Ooh, Quasi Duplicate's pretty sweet, though. Cackling Counterpart was played a little bit, and that card was dope.
Oh, man, that was my thing in Standard. I love that shit.
It was sweet. Now you just... I wish that... So it's like, part of me wishes that Jumpstart was like reaching trace where you could just keep doing it, but then I feel like it would be too good. Because then you could just like filter through.
Oh, yeah. Deck. Yeah, that would be hard to balance, I think.
I think this card is definitely good. I think it's just going to be nice for the control deck of the format, which is probably going to be maybe Sultai. Maybe is it... probably not... Well, could continue to be Esper. You still have Teferi, you still have Vraska's Contempt.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good cards still, but I think a shift more toward like a Jeskai control or maybe just playing blue white is fine. But I think that's a fine card. I don't think it's amazing. But it's not bad. I think it's fine and I think it'll see play for sure. However, it's got to compete in that 2-mana draw card slot. It's got to compete with Anticipate.
Yeah, is Anticipate still going to be in Standard after the rotation?
Yep. They just put it in M19.
Oh, okay.
So, the cards... Really, I'm a lot more interested in this Surveil mechanic. Because I think there's probably going to be some sweet stuff going on. There seems to be a really natural synergy between Golgari and Dimir that Wizard seems to be just kind of shoving in front of you between Surveil and Undergrowth.
Yeah.
And also literally putting Narcomoeba in this set.
Yeah. So, yeah, Narcomoeba is some payoff for the Surveil for sure.
Yeah, and like so me, you know, I don't just play Modern, I also play Pauper. I have my Pauper Cube. Like some of the big things that I'm looking at, right? Like this card, Whisper Agent. That card's sweet.
Yeah, that's very cool.
And honestly, I don't think it'll be good enough for Constructed, but that card's sweet. You could play it in like your Teachings deck and Pauper. I'll be putting it in the cube. It's got Flash. It's a 3/2 for 3 when it enters the battlefield. Surveil 1. It's just sweet.
Yeah.
It's like almost like, you know, I think the Surveil mechanic is really, really nice. Just like, it's this essentially more or less free card selection that's just stapled onto cards.
It's really hard to evaluate at this point until you play with it, right? And until you see what's in the rest of the set. But I'm inclined to think that Dream Eater is going to be strong because Surveil 4 is by far the largest Surveil that we've seen on a creature. And it does so much more than that. And agree to disagree, Zach, but my prediction is that we're going to see a hell of a lot of this card in Standard.
I'm not going to try to change your mind. We'll see what happens. I'm going to say that it's going to not really perform.
Okay.
That's going to be my prediction. I think this card's going to be one of those cards that looks super sweet and ends up just being a bulk mythic. But we'll definitely see. I have been wrong, and I've been surprised in the past. So I'm not saying that's impossible. I'm a little disappointed at the super restrictive mana cost on Niv-Mizzet, because that looks really sweet.
Yeah, he looks very cool, but... Blue, red is tough.
I love me some Niv-Mizzet, man. I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
And then Thought Eraser, a really good sideboard card. Just 2-mana Thought Seize, and then Surveil 1. It's pretty good. Yeah. I guess it's a color shifted Castigate.
Yeah, that's what it is. Blue black target. You don't exile the card though. They discard it. Excuse me.
Oh, just Castigate exile.
I think it is, yeah. Maybe not. Anyways, I have no doubts that one will see play in sideboards at the least.
Yeah, that card's sweet. And then there's one more Surveil card that I really liked. It's the Cancel. Cancel with Surveil 1. That card is good.
Strict upgrade from the counter target spell Scry 1 that we've had in the past, so...
I don't know about strict upgrade. I think it's kind of lateral. I think it really depends on your deck. Okay. Now, in a situation where it would be a strict upgrade, let's say you're, you know, you go turn two, search for Azcanta, turn three, Sinister Sabotage, dump a card in your bin. Now we're talking about strict upgrade. Or well, if your top card is Narcomoeba, that's pretty hot.
In the corner cases where you would rather have a card on the bottom of your library than in your graveyard, I would agree with you that it is not a strict upgrade. But there are 99% more chances that you're going to be more interested in having it in your yard. Let's move on. We got one more we want to talk about, and we're running out of time here, so let's keep it kind of short. But the third one that I wanted to talk about that I think might have some modern potential, and I could be wrong. I don't see where this belongs yet, but it's definitely interesting.
Is it the 5-mana sorcery?
No, it's not. It is March of the Multitudes, actually.
Oh.
And that is a mythic, and it's recently been spoiled. It's X green, white, white for an instant with Convoke. Already I like it, right? We're going somewhere when it's instant speed, X and Convoke. It says, create X 1/1 white soldier creature tokens with lifelink. Now, this, to me, seems like the type of card that is like one of those situations where you're setting up for a collected company type of scenario. End of turn, you maybe flash this in and draw out a counterspell so you can go to town on the next turn and play all the creatures you want. Best case scenario, they don't have anything for it, and you're left with a bunch of 1/1 white soldier tokens with lifelink. It doesn't seem bad. I just don't know where that belongs. It, you know, if these were elves, we'd be talking.
Yeah, and I think that was definitely intentional with not making those elves. I was literally immediately before we got on the podcast, I checked the Green-White Discord, and somebody shared this spoiler.
Yeah.
And my thoughts were pretty concise on it. This card's hot. I think it's really sweet. I think it's going to be a nice alternate win condition for Bant Nexus.
Uh-huh.
But I don't see it having a home in Modern, really. There's just not a conceivable shell I have where there's, you know, either already a better option or it just doesn't really fit with the game plan. The fact that, you know, I like that. I think WotC was actually really, really smart with designing this card by putting a green in it. So it's not something that, you know, Jeskai can just jam in there instead of, like, secure the waste or something.
Yeah.
This card is definitely sweet, though, and it'll be nice. I think this actually, if we're being completely real, I think the best shell for this is going to be, and I'm going to keep coming back to this, I think there's going to be an Abzan mid-range deck in Standard. And I think this is going to be really good as either a win condition or a sideboard card for aggressive decks, where you basically just build up your board, you kind of sit there, you make your land drops, you're probably a 26 land deck, and then you just like end step, make this gigantic March of the Multitudes. You're playing Shalai and stuff like that in your deck, so you're protected from Settle the Wreckage. I think that's going to be the deck to put this in.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's definitely going to have a home in Standard. It's got some slight potential for Modern. Once again, I don't see where it belongs in Modern at this point. But yeah. It's some pretty big token payoff. So if you're in like a black-white token deck, it basically allows you to double your board presence, which with like Lingering Souls or whatever the token decks choose to play, that's pretty impactful. It could be enough to just win the game on the next turn, right?
Yeah.
So if there's some sort of like Lingering Soul splash green deck, I think March of the Multitudes belongs in there. And I don't know what that looks like yet, but and maybe it's this card that is what's needed for that to be done. You know, there's been a lot of Abzan type of token decks in the past. In Standard, we've seen a lot of them. I think that Modern's got a lot of tools for it.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is there's not, like, a Bant control deck in Modern. If there was, I think this would, well, there's people trying to play the Bant pile. But
yeah, it's not.
If there was, like, a Bant control deck in Modern, this would be sweet. But it's, you know, again, you still have to ask if you're going to play this. Well, why wouldn't you just play
Secure the Wreckage? Or,
Secure the Waste. Or even White Sun Zenith.
Right. Yeah, so, this needs creatures to be good. I don't think it belongs in a control deck because you're paying three additional mana for the same effect. And now the lifelink really isn't going to be that appealing for you if you just want to go big and, like, drop a bunch of dudes and attack.
Yeah. I think it would be sweet in that Bant pile that some people are trying, because you can play kind of like a more mid-rangey control deck, and then this would be like a really nice win condition, since you're not playing like collected companies or anything like that. You're just playing like Jace, Teferi, and some sweepers and some good value creatures. I think it'd be sweet there, but yeah. I don't think that's a deck that's really going to make its way onto the metagame as a whole.
Sure. Yeah. It's a long shot, but I'd love to see it. I think
Jokins
are fun. Anyways, man, I think we ought to close out on that. We had a big one today with that Assassin's Trophy, so I think we'll probably have to simmer on that one for a little while, and I'm looking forward to seeing what that does for sure.
Absolutely. That card's going to do big things. Absolutely. Like, no doubts.
No doubts, yeah. All right, dude. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah,
good luck with
thanks
the storm.
Yeah, well, if I'm... I don't know. If I die, I'll have to figure out who I'm going to will all my cards to.
Yeah. Maybe we'll do a little sweepstakes in that case.
There you go. We'll be all right.
All right. Take care.
Bye, man.
Bye. Card Knock Life is proud to be a part of mtgcast.com. We can be reached at cardknocklifepodcast.com or on Twitter at card_knock_life. We're always looking for more help in generating content for the website, and if you'd be interested in doing so, please email at cardknocklifepodcast@gmail.com.